listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
And so tonight we are very pleased to have 10 talented writers share their work with us, two from each of the five participating schools. And their names and the order in which they will be reading is listed on the little program that you picked up on the way in. And if you didn't get one, I see that there are a few back on this wooden credenza here. And in addition to our readers who will be introducing themselves when they come up, I would like to especially thank all of the professors who've been working with us over the past few months to put this program together. From Otis, that is Sarah Swen-Yen Bynum and Paul Vengalisti. From USC, Prince Gomolvilas and Bridget Mullins. From CalArts, Jen Hoffer and Janet Sarbanes. From UC Irvine, Michelle Latioli. And from UC Riverside, Susan Strait, Michael Jaime, and Katie Ford. So here's to celebrating our rich literary community and emerging writers at the LA Public Library. Let's give a round of applause to our first reader, Nicole Olwen.
Hello, I'm Nicole, and I have three poems for you. Peace be upon you, O people of the graves. Assalamu alaikum ya alil kabur. My ancestors, I haven't come to you for words. My tongue and your tongues have known different shapes for God, for amygdala. My body has less grace than one who knows her own soft history, unabridged. Can you give me this string to hold? Can you hold this other end, so that it hangs not limp in the dirt? My brother speaks of angels. We learned the way the world widens, but first, the padded sound of a prayer rug unraveled, the cold spine of a rosary at once held and eaten. Brother, we spoke two languages, neither well enough, and so we lifted our tongues from the choir. We know the faithless seek communion in the corners of their beds, in the way their lovers hold the trembling bird of silence. In death's blank verse, in its bleached gown, the angels know they are godless. They bring candles in the morning, burn the day to blackened ash. Kaleidoscope. Give me the morning's yellow river of hair, the fast contraction of your pupils. The way an iris holds history in pixels is the way you broke me open into light. Thank you.
My name is Sean Pessin, and I'll be reading my short story, an excerpt from my short story, Tabitha. Tabitha is an excellent name for a child you'd treat like a dog if you'd treat a dog poorly. This dog, this Tabitha, you'd let her wander off, for it's the kind of name that's good for a child that would wander off when her parent was not looking, and it's the kind of name for a child whose parent would not look for her when she'd wander off. This name is the perfect name for a child you'd never hug or consider at all when remarrying after her mother or father died mysteriously. Tabitha is the kind of child you'd starve of all kinds of things. Attention is hardly the most immediate. Tabitha is an excellent name for a child you'd treat like a dog if you'd treat a dog poorly. Tabitha is the kind of name for a child that would wander into the woods thinking, Tabitha, you really ought to get some food to stop the low grumbling in your stomach from becoming a much louder and deeper grumbling. And just at that moment, for fortune is this way, A crow would come to hear the chorus of Gasta's shifting around her gut. A Tabitha would scratch behind her ears, the left and then the right, and the crow would look on, taking in the scene before calling down from her own high perch and asking if Tabitha needed something to eat. A Tabitha in this situation may have many responses. No, for my neglectful parents could at any moment realize that I am not around, and this might trigger for them an overwhelming set of feelings that will only occur to them through this kind of loss. Or a Tabitha might say, yes, but I'm afraid of what you may lead me to, so would you mind introducing yourself to me, Crow, before you offer to help? Or a Tabitha might say, I am so sorry, but I don't speak Crow. But far more likely, a Tabitha would say, yes, I am so very hungry, and I don't know when it's appropriate to trust strangers yet, for I have no one in my life that one should properly trust. So a strange bird is good enough. A child named Tabitha, a child who'd be treated poorly, would also be the kind of child to be led by a crow to the city. The city is the kind of place children go to be treated like dogs if one is inclined to treat dogs poorly. The city is a perfect place for Tabithas. And the crow knows all about the city. The crow has worked out how directional lanes work and how stoplights work and how right-of-ways and crosswalks work, so they are, in a sense, the best kind of guide that Tabithas could hope for when being led through a new place like the city. And the crow would lead a Tabitha to a supermarket, preferably a chain even, a large chain, where there are loaves of bread breathing out their yeasty breaths into the street, where they rest on large baker's racks and front windows, windows displaying signs prohibiting solicitations. And the crow would land on the large illuminated letters spelling out the name of that large chain supermarket as they hang over the automated front doors and caw to its Tabitha charge, "Do you want to eat a loaf of this bread?" And the child, who would whimper as earnestly as she could muster, "Yes, please, for love's sake, yes. I would like to eat something before I waste away." This child is the kind of child to be named Tabitha, for only a Tabitha would want to eat warm bread on these terms. And a crow who'd take time out of a busy day of dropping walnuts and crosswalks so that cars would crack them easier than the crow could on its own is the same kind of crow who'd fly into a supermarket as a customer with an abominably large feathered hat would slither in, slumping their long, scaly body to duck under the sensor of the automatic door because the sensor of the automatic door would crease the long feathers tucked into the band of that large hat. All these details would incite the dodge and flight that the crow would make to swoop in and claim a loaf of bread from the bakery section of the large chain supermarket and swiftly fly out as the serpentine spectacle of a patron tried to enter the shop. A crow like this crow would have to be the kind of crow to drop the loaf of bread on the ground, and the Tabitha would, because of this, be the kind of child that quickly leave her station at the side of the door, next to the prohibitions regarding solicitations, to scoop up the loaf from the sidewalk, then quickly hide herself in the parking lot. Whether it be in the front of the store or the back to scarf the bread as fast as the crust of the loaf would allow doesn't really matter. The kind of child that would be treated poorly as a result of being given a name for a dog's life would cover herself in crumbs, as this is an action typical to a Tabitha, typical for a dog you'd let wander off without searching for her later. Her crow companion would be the kind to ask if she wanted some more bread, and the Tabitha, depending on age and appetite, may say yes, and the scene would repeat when a figure cloaked in black velvet, punctured only by long, crooked fingers, came to enter the large chain supermarket, or when a ghost fisherman trailed by a tangle of spectral line would approach the automatic door in the place of the scaly customer in the initial scenario, or with any mark that would trigger the doors to open in this ruse. That is, until the Tabitha says no. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Nayila Orr, and I'm going to be reading an excerpt from my thesis called High Maintenance. A new billboard on Virgil Avenue near Fountain neatly reflects the ever-changing tastes of the inhabitants of LA's hipster preserves of Los Feliz and Silver Lake, neighborhoods to the north and east of my own, the genre-defying East Hollywood. 9 billboards of varying size lend an outsized commercial presence to this 3-block radius, underscoring the influence of Hollywood and Sunset Boulevards, the 2 main thoroughfares that cut through this strip. Each ad bears its own message, designed to resonate with the audience drawn to the neighborhood's signature businesses: community yoga studios, bike repair shops, yuppie dog food joints, and the Vista Theater, a single-screen Art Deco movie house with a green neon sign that reads simply, Vista, and burns all night long. At first glance, this new billboard's image is something of an apotheosis of this laid-back hub of lifestyle commerce, at least when you see it backlit against the evening sky. A white hipster Jesus in a bike helmet. On closer inspection, though, you realize you're looking at a guileless-looking guy staring back at you with Seth Rogen's signature stoner face. Yet it's not Seth Rogen. It's the guy, a weed delivery man played by Ben Sinclair, who, along with Kaja Blichfeld, is the co-creator and writer of Vimeo's cult hit web series, High Maintenance. The guy exudes the insular hipster aura of his surroundings. He looks faded and a little blurred against a white and yellow background. On the yellow side, bold text reads, "The greatest show not on television is back." The tagline references Vimeo's online-only platform, but functions another way. It suggests some kind of surreptitious off-screen movement, a furtive cover for redrawing the public face of pot dealing in America. It's not hard to see why the show's marketers have hit upon this faux subversive formula. High Maintenance marks the beginning of a new era in mainstream American pop culture, the whitewashing of the weed dealer. Recent depictions of the white pot dealer were either too outlandish, too goofy, or too Indian set too far in the past to take seriously. But High Maintenance is very much of the hipster capitalist moment. The show is set in New York City, where the guy bikes around Brooklyn serving bud on the slide to his mostly white, upper middle class clientele. The seeming dissonance of pot dealing plunked into the domestic rounds of privileged hipster life is what fuels most of the show's comedy. High Maintenance chronicles the guy's adventures as a buzz-dispensing traveling salesman. Each new episode, which ranges between 5 and 19 minutes, reflects some new dimension of the largely bourgeois weed economy. As the guy helps his clients with some issue that needs fixing or rehashing, carting munchies from a takeout joint, or showing some middle-aged first-timer how to roll one, the show's audience grows steadily more inured to seeing pot dealing as just another quirky stop on the landscape of the casualized service economy. And indeed, the show has gained topicality as it renders the mundanity of home pot consumption. Its later episodes overlap with a real-world loosening of pot laws, with Washington and Colorado, and more recently Washington, D.C., approving ballot initiatives to legalize marijuana. Although High Maintenance may be a Vimeo original, the guy is not. The character is a direct reference to the guy, slang for weed dealer, i.e., I'm meeting my guy tonight, can I get you anything while I'm out? The guy is the pop culture archetype of the amiable drug dealer. One of his obvious forebears is the dude, the burned out hippie played for Knowing Less by Jeff Bridges in the 1998 Coen Brothers cult film, The Big Lebowski. But the dude was better known as a consumer rather than as a dealer of drugs. A more relevant variation on the guy's image is probably my man, as in Lou Reed's I'm Waiting for My Man. The pusher man, as famously evoked by Curtis Mayfield and rendered in blaxploitation flicks, is the opposite of the guy. Harsh, predatory, and cruel. Blichfeld and Curtis, by gracing the guy with this generic name, acknowledges the tradition, but have also shorn it of its implied menace, suggesting instead that their character embodies an everyman's sensibility. However, the guy's seeming universality masks an important tension between the kind of drug dealing that pop culture productions mine harmless comic fodder and the kind that our carceral state takes very seriously, the tension of race. This is the factor that typically decides whose mug is on a billboard and whose is in a mugshot. Not that drug dealing is by any means a monopoly of people of color. Plenty of white dealers are moving product, especially as pot nudges its way into the orbit of legitimate commerce. But the shift symbolized by the guy, the whitewashing of the drug game, tends to evoke a rough racial parody in pop cult portrayals of drug dealing where none actually exists. High maintenance is, as my neighborhood billboard readily reminds us, a direct response to the liberal climate that's developed as more states and municipalities legalize recreational pot. That some critics have lauded the show as revolutionary reveals our collective amnesia when it comes to even quite recent entertainment patterns. You could easily write off this lapse in racial awareness to the notoriously bad memory that afflicts heavy pot users. But it's rooted in a more serious and more prototypically American condition, a failure to reckon with the history of race as it's played out in our drug-themed entertainments. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Paula Tang, and I'll be reading Owen Pittman Buys a Goldfish. This excerpt is told from the teen's perspective of Sulin Wong, whose father has recently bought the abandoned IHOP on the corner to start his own Chinese restaurant, and Owen Pittman, the boy who's infatuated with her. Little China House, the neighborhood Chinese restaurant that Sulin's family owned, had been vandalized earlier that week. Local news had covered the attack, saying that the vandals had stolen alcohol, kitchen knives, and a side of beef. The restaurant had been generally overturned, but Owen Pittman thought the desecration of the 50-gallon fish tank was the most depressing of all. They had poisoned the fish with some kind of liquor that turned the water electric blue. On television, the network had unsuccessfully blurred out the giant flaccid penis that had been spray-painted on the tank's face. He thought about this now as he stood with his nose nearly to the glass of the restaurant's window, holding a once robust but now near lifeless goldfish he had bought for Sulin from a pet store. Sulin hardly swore. She thought it was a lazy way to express oneself. Saying you feel like shit, for example, actually says very little compared to the great many ways you can more firmly express your discomfort. But when she saw Owen Pittman standing with his hand cupped over his brow against the window, holding a plastic bag filled with water and what appeared to be a goldfish, she was overwhelmed with a single word response. Fuck. Owen Pittman had once helped Sulin locate her mother at the swap meet by suggesting they ride the dumpy Ferris wheel to gain a better view of the grounds. Sulin had spent the entire ride trying not to pee, flitting her eyes from the spiderweb situated in the corner of the gondola to the hole in Owen's sneaker, sending signals to her bladder to remain strong while Owen pointed to each black head of hair, asking if it was her mom until it was. The following Monday before school, her mother had insisted she bring a recently defrosted Yule log Christmas cake left over from the holidays and give it to him in thanks. "He won't know," she had said, scraping off the edible snowflake decal with a butter knife. Sulin ate the snowflake and insisted that yes, yes he would, and promptly left the house. At school, Sulin had looked at her watch, counting down to the minute before the bell rang, and then down to the minute of official tardiness, and decided that Owen Pittman was the stupidest person in the world for making her wait in the hallway, holding a chocolate Yule log like some kind of idiot. That was years ago, when she was 12 and soft. Today he was here, at the restaurant. She had spent the entire afternoon scrubbing dick drawings from the restroom's mirror, calling cards left by the vandals who had robbed and overturned the restaurant the night before. The mixture of cleaning fluids did little more than smudge the felt-tipped peonies that danced across her reflection. She would not be made a clown again, she thought, as she unlocked the door. Owen took a step back. "It's a fish," he said, almost apologetic. "For you. It needs some fresh water. Do you have a container? Something to put it in?" The black goldfish lay on its side with its tail pinched together. It wasn't pretty. Its body was covered in raised lumps, and its eyes rotated round and round in their sockets, looking without seeing. Condensation dripped down the inside of the bag. Sulin held the door open, ushering him in inside after he hesitated at the threshold. And then he tripped. Owen's vision fragmented, the fish propelling itself against the bag as it fell, the water spreading flat like a sheet of paper upon impact, the fish still slick with its own mucus slapping against the worn carpet. Sulin dropped to her knees and clutched the fish in her hand like it was a phone or a hot pocket. They watched it heave once, then stop, its belly concave. Its eyes searched once more, then stilled. "Thank you," she said. "It's beautiful." Owen couldn't look up, couldn't look away from the jelly film that had begun to dry in the fish's bulbous eye. "You're welcome." In the restroom, Owen tried not to notice the mirror. Sulin laid the fish gently in the toilet bowl. The fish sank face down, its tail sticking out from the water at an unnatural angle. They stood silent for a moment, honoring the death, but Sulin could not help but replay the vision of Owen's flailing attempt at catching the bag before it fell, the splat pop it had made upon arrival, while Owen spun down, down deep into a K-hole of regret, his obsessive-compulsive disorder confronting his disaster-prone self, looping into a series of whys. When the fish began expanding in the water, they knew they'd been fooled. When the fish righted itself and unfurled its tail and fins like laundry in sudden wind, they absolutely knew they'd been tricked. And when it reared back before squirming to work itself through the hole and down the outlet, they knew they would never see the fish again. In Owen's mind, the fish was stuck in the U-bend passageway where it would suffocate alone in the dark. In Sulin's, the fish had escaped the pipe workings of the restaurant and was already on its way to the ocean. No matter that it wasn't a saltwater fish, no matter that it was used to store-bought food flakes and oxygen pumped through a hose, it would learn to hunt for krill, would learn how to move with the waves. The suburban strip mall terror was already a faraway memory in the fish's mind. It would thrive in the ocean because it must. Sulin flushed the toilet once, then twice for good measure, then a third time to urge it onward and away. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Amanda Fouché. I'm going to read just an excerpt of an early scene from a novel called East. And I hope it doesn't need any context, but I guess you'll tell me afterwards. Upstairs, her son writhes in the dark. He is awake and wanting June to know it. She shut the door on his shouting an hour ago, a fight about bedtime. And she has not yet relinquished her anger, is living inside of its simplicity. It has been a difficult day. He is increasingly difficult. He is making the routine of his care increasingly difficult. And when she thinks the words again, they seem to lose their precision. She hears him throw his body in the room upstairs. She hears his fists against the wall, and the quick, successive scooting of the bed's wood feet on the wood floor. "It's worse," she says into the phone. And then she cannot quite explain that she sees something growing violent in him, in Frank, her elder son, theirs, hers and Anna's, this child they've made. "Did something happen today?" Anna asks. "You're not giving me anything to go on." June can almost see her wife sitting up, exasperated in their bed in Brooklyn. Anna is in a world apart, her days full of work, floor plans, the angular models of her firm's glass projects, doting colleagues. June knows that she, Anna, cannot quite imagine the minutiae of their everyday, the feeding and the fighting and the cleaning up. June wishes she could diagram every hour, quantify the effort of it in terms Anna might understand. It's as if June thinks she believes we are not moving, that her car pulling into the drive on late Friday nights wills us into being again. Anna is saying, "I don't know what you want me to say. I've told you his little outbursts don't really worry me. You sound exhausted." June eases her body down to the floor, and in that downward motion, there is relief, the dissolution of her posture as mother, adult. She spreads her bare legs out on the cool tile. She leans her back against the cabinets. She sees her face and body reflected in the kitchen's sliding glass doors, the pliant curled phone cord stretching umbilical from its plastic housing on the wall. The sliding glass doors hold an entire ghostly copy of the soft-lit room, and then the night beyond that, and more night somehow, because of the proximal size of the sea beyond the marsh, that massive dark. It dwarfs her. Did something happen today? June cannot quite bring herself to tell it. She wants the support with none of the risk, none of the details that might lay bare her own shortcomings as a parent. A child, she thinks of herself, holding that word up, expecting it from her wife. "You're acting like a child." And then she settles into childhood and lets that notion wrap her up like the dark. "I don't want to tell you," she is surprised to say aloud. I just want you to agree with me. I want you to say, you're right. Something is wrong with Frank, but whatever it is, we'll figure it out. Here, she pauses, waits for Anna to respond. She listens to her own breath rake the receiver, and, in the time it takes for the phone to refract and replay the noise of her exhalation, she feels her anger change shape. She feels herself draw closer to Frank, to the way he writhes and pushes against what will not move. If she knew it before, she does not remember that she resents Anna for this life. "We are anything but still here," she says, and she thinks it is her right not to tell it. She is the one alone with them, the one who birthed them, the one wiping the persistent paste of shit from their bottoms. She opens her mouth, prepares herself for some kind of soliloquy, and then she breathes again. She is alone with the children because they had agreed on it long ago, that she, June, a teacher, would take the summers with them on the coast, that Anna, an architect, would drive up from Brooklyn on the weekends to the house she had renovated for them. Before their sons, the routine was meant to facilitate June's writing, time alone. A hobby, really, she had started to say a year into the marriage. And then there was Frank, and the obsessive attention he required, the gnawing on her breasts, the colicky shrieks of a half-formed thing that had slipped from the womb too early. The summer distills June's body into a machine of motherhood, the hours measured out into the proper sections of eating and sleeping, not too much television or sweets or sun, not too much of anything, outside to play, inside to eat, outside to play, bath, bed. Her mind seems to wander, mellifluous, out of time, in the ether of days lived for children. Frank still resents us for the baby, Anna is saying, don't you think? We're all still adjusting. Maybe he needs more structure next summer, summer camp, something. He's too old to sit around the house with you all day. He's 7. I just don't think all of these things are necessarily pointing to each other. The food, the fits. He pushes you because he can. What do you mean, pointing to each other? June asks. June, Anna says. What do you mean, pointing? She asks again. It's all happening to him, to his body. Earlier that afternoon, June had been feeding the baby. At 1 year old, Joe was adroit in his avoidance of food. All the book said, give the child their own utensil, help them feel in control. And so she spent his meals watching him toss that bright extra spoon onto the floor. When she picked it up again, tried to leave it on the table out of his reach, he began to wail and knocked the steamed peas and pasta off the tray with one clean swipe of his arm. She had been cleaning it up on her hands and knees when she heard the sliding glass doors, Frank's heavy breathing. Through the table's wood legs, she could see his rigid bare feet, the braided bit of yarn he had tied to his left ankle. It charmed her, that string, its youthful androgyny. And she remembered her body sheltered under the table, the baby's food in the palm of her hand, to be good to him, her elder child, still so young, she had thought, that red string. She put a hand on the chair to pull herself up, and Frank's face appeared from the underside of the table. A bruise, marled and purple, had bloomed in a crescent under his eye. There was a section of skin bubbled up in a blister, and she could see it pulling taut his cheek, the blood and pus that had filled it up. It was not some ordinary injury. Frank, she had said, but she did not go to him. She did not scoop him up and offer him ice for the eye. She could not. She stood feeling the strain of Joe's game in her lower back and thighs. She could feel that the floor had left her knees red, and she felt compelled then to bend down and trace the gritted ridges of skin shaped by the tile's pattern. The soft food in her hands seemed to shift to Frank's innards, and she dropped it again. Joe laughed at this. She could not bring herself to ask what happened. She did not want to know how a child could come inside from playing alone in the grass with the broad, blooming shape of a black eye on his own face. She had yelled, and it frightened him. It was another piece of the story she did not want told. He was hurting himself. He was unnerving her. This nervous pride, she had thought, standing there between her sons in the kitchen, She thinks it again now as Anna goes on talking. This nervous pride of two women raising sons. Frank's whole body feels like a test. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Michael Mitchell, and I will be reading an excerpt from a novel I'm working on that takes place in New Orleans right after the Civil War. This is the moment when my protagonist, a Creole woman, and her future white lover meet for the first time as teenagers. The old grandfather clock in the downstairs entryway had struck three. That was 5 minutes ago. Celestine stood on the porch of Leticia's house like a Corinthian column, nose thin and proud, threatening to slice the sky like a blade. She knew that Leticia was making her wait on purpose. She knew that the old woman would always make her wait, every day until the end of time, for exactly 5 minutes. A minute for every stretch of money Leticia had lost in Pierre Louise's canceled betrothal. Her only son, a boy full of noble old world blood and new world promise, who was expected to marry high and white, to only take a Creole mistress as an aside, a footnote to his one true appropriate marriage. 300 seconds for the number of days their relationship had lasted. Days wasted on the Negro girl with the nasty temper tangled in her pretty braids. Celestine didn't mind waiting, especially not today. She would wait for 5 more minutes if she had to, because they would be the last 5 minutes she'd ever have to stand on the wraparound porch, its steps lined with ceramic pots, stuffed with gardenias. She was 16 when she first met Pierre Louis after he crashed a party with a group of youths drunk off of Sazeracs and social privilege. Celestine sat in her little seat by the window of her cousin's house and watched the boy stumble about like wild centaurs, groping corseted waist and Creole breasts, emboldened by the girl's screams of feigned outrage. Pierre Louis was the tallest and skinniest of the bunch, with limbs as long and awkward as a newborn calf. He stumbled over his words as he approached each girl, cheeks flushed with lust and embarrassment, freckles dotting his face like constellations. The girls giggled in the face of his shyness, the room dark and heady, his forehead beaded with sweat. He was certainly trying, and it was the trying that made him stumble harder, and the stumbling made him cuter, redder, sweatier. Celestine sipped from her glass of sherry, her body as still as a statue, dark eyes wet with longing. It took a while for Pierre Louis to turn around and spot Celestine sitting alone, nursing her drink, as lovely as a doll. She was pale, with rich black hair braided into two loops on either side of her face, tied by cornflower blue ribbons that carefully matched her taffeta gown. When he looked at her, she looked down and away, lips pressed demurely against the lip of her glass. He felt his face radiate heat, the blood rushing to his head, and his skull too. Time crashed into itself like a derailed freight train. She looked up again and smiled shyly as the party swirled around them. Pierre Louis navigated the sea of bodies pressed against one another, Celestine acting as his beacon, but was blown off course by her cousin, Marriott, an unfortunate piece of flotsam. She was pretty and chatty, the booze she'd consumed sprouting into heavy blossoms on her reddened cheeks. She whispered excitedly in Celestine's ear, curls bouncing, heavy with secrets, then grabbed her by the hand and led her into the sea, carried away like Europa on the bull. Pierre Louis looked around, hoping to catch up, but lost sight of the blue ribbons. He cursed himself and Marriott for the rest of the night. He walked home alone, his companions had already carried off their evening conquests, and pictured the girl on the window seat, hoping to imprint the image onto his memory. He went over what he would say to her, debating as to whether bonjour was too formal and if a simple salute would suffice, if he should extend his hand to hers or if that would set his sweaty palms up for failure, if he should act brave and unconquerable, even if he wasn't any of those things by nature, or content himself to never having her in this lifetime or the next. And then he imagined himself making love to her and felt his hidden courage in the sweet heat of her breath as it scalded the small dimple at the base of his throat. He imagined himself inside of her, even though he was already betrothed, to slip himself inside of a nice French girl made nicer by her money, a match arranged by his mother. He imagined himself into Celestine's bed, then her heart, and with mind made up, turned on his heel and started back towards the house. It was nearly dawn when Marriott stirred, a hairy arm draped across her chest. Her parents were gone, visiting relatives in Mississippi, so she took her sweet time in plucking the arm from around her body, remembering that she had left Celestine on the other side of the door to honor her conquest with a proper audience once he gathered his clothes and slinked out of the room. She tiptoed across the wooden floor and quietly opened the door, expecting Celestine to be asleep in the hallway's grand armchair or gone entirely, too annoyed to have been left alone for longer than anticipated. But Marriott was shocked to find her cousin wrapped in the long arms of a freckled boy, their lips pressed together in desperation, his fingers occasionally making their way up to the base of her throat. She smiled sneakily to herself, then closed the door. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Melissa Gutierrez. I'm going to read two poems about the city, one about a past experience of mine and one about the afterlife. The first one's called Oasis. But really, though, the convent didn't prepare me for this. For the beautiful drag queens lip-syncing on stage, the stamps on my skin, on my oven burn, the heat of a crowd warmed from the inside out by LA water, cosmos, exotic drinks with rum that spin the room like the music that slides against the walls, against posters on the walls of men with bigger breasts and lovelier faces, and joy so palpable I'm proud of strangers in the crowd and on the stage, all here for the change in rhythm I give, because why keep the status quo? New shapes, copies of infinity, hips and unfamiliar hands, feathers and beads and air, fresh in the parking lot, the blood cooling in our veins, and I begin to concern myself with the driver who's had a couple and the insufficient material of my jacket. Food betrayals. The time you were adventurous and tried the crocodile dishes, the first fried in batter tasted like particularly tough chicken, and the second, hunks of patterned flesh plumped into a plate full of spiced red liquid, smelled like cinnamon and tasted like cinnamon, and felt half decayed as it slid between your teeth, melted over your tongue, and slipped down your throat, ensuring that you would avoid all Thai food back in the States for at least 2 years. The two times, three times, four times you went to Yoshinoya to eat the beef bowl. Each sliver of meat attached to another by the thinnest tendon, which you didn't bother to cut. You just swallowed the one and had to decide, while choking, whether to try and swallow the second or pull the first back up. The 2 months without salt. The Japanese restaurant where she told you it wouldn't taste like fish, so you took a huge bite of unagi sushi. The recipes in the treatment book that looked great until you tried them. The 17th occasion on which the restaurant got your order wrong and you finally broke down. All the times you spat up as a child, regurgitating things you were certain you hadn't eaten at all recently. The bite of guacamole at your mom's friend's house, homemade with tortilla chips, that tasted so good you had 3 more bites before your throat began to close. When you forgot that the full feeling is a warning, kept stealing fries off of your dad's plate, your brother's barbecue ribs, your cousin's baked potatoes so large it needed its own plate, until your tiny stomach swelled so much you didn't stop crying until the Pepto kicked in. Desperately eating a cheeseburger after the low iodine diet and the inability to digest it afterward. Trying to laugh at a Woody Allen movie and the inability to do so past the ache in your spine. The time you accidentally drank a sip of your best friend's beer, didn't like it, and poured the rest down the sink. The beer that another friend had brought back from England. Thoughts of the food in the hospital room. The plastic-wrapped wheat roll, the rice, the freezer vegetables, and the roast beef. Smells of the ochre marinade, saltless, making you just as nauseous as after the radiation pill made you throw it all back up. After the hospital, able to eat again and smelling the waffle cones in the ice cream parlor, picking Rocky Road and tasting absolutely nothing. In front of a plate of fettuccine Alfredo and tasting absolutely nothing. The times you burned your tongue on the breakfast tea. LA Cafe. The line's grown long again. I've counted 6 pairs of black work shoes. Every person has nice shoes. For some reason, people insist on sweatshirts. I'd like a Sunday hat to wear to church, though I don't go to church. Perhaps the church should advertise hats as a selling point. Being unfreckled, I wish freckles were my problem. 2 paper cups across a table might say to each other, I know what it's like to be empty too. The noise is constant. Several conversations congregate in the recesses of the room like a flock of reed-voiced birds discussing politics, cynically. Interviewers have taken over an entire half of a cafe. At some point, I'll stop staring at the pastries behind glass, glazed as if freshly made rather than a day-old remainder. The line has gotten longer. A girl's shirt reads, "Game on," but I don't know what she means exactly. Pre-gaming implies one needs inebriation to enjoy padded body jousting. What do you say to the man with 2 llamas fucking on his shirt? Uncle Sam is on a button on the man's backpack, and he's angry about the man's wardrobe selection. What not to wear, Founding Father edition. Sir, your ideals don't match your party colors. Never pair flippancy with neoliberalism. He should try a cooler palette. After. Like clockwork, each limb will continue to tick. Pointed fingers, bent legs, bowed backs, until the rust settles in and sticks between the gears until we stop. I have plans for that eventuality. Whatever relatives are left will take my ashes to the nearest lake, and I will rise up and out into the world. After visiting the tourist traps, I will dig into each individual house, each life, and learn things. There will be nothing but time. I plan to play the poltergeist, making radios jump, exhuming porn stashes, hiding socks. I will smile with the place that used to hold my smile. Once the earth seems too familiar, I will leave through the hatch in the atmosphere and swim to the nearest solar systems. Where did the neighbors go? How can I play hide and seek with the dead that have preceded me? I will follow the fluidity of time streams across the universe, examine the remains of old civilizations, meet the microcosms breeding between the rocks, shaded from a sun just beginning to turn sour. Find out where the black holes lead. At the edges of space, where the rest have finally collected before stepping over, consider whether or not sated curiosity is worth walking off the edge to whatever comes next. Unless it doesn't work like that. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Julian Smith Newman. I'm going to read an excerpt from the beginning of a long story entitled Territory. He's looking for something, but he doesn't know what it is. he isn't unhappy. Actually, a vague sense of contentment is usually what he feels. A floating contentment, made easier by the gentle climate of his city, the lush profusion of his neighborhood's yards. But then it's there again, a sort of shadow. Maybe he just wants to be the kind of person who can undergo a change. On YouTube, he watches the most recent beheadings. He reads the CIA torture report. These aren't things from which he tries to shield himself, though neither does he indulge in them like some people he knows. There is a kind of guilt that feeds on itself and that therefore differs little from pleasure, and he wants to avoid this kind of guilt at all costs. Still, he wants to understand the world in which he lives. He thinks that maybe by watching these videos, reading these words, he'll understand more fully how to act with respect to them, how to be in a world in which they also are. How are these things present for him? The truth, he knows, is that they are everywhere. In the food he buys at the farmer's market and the air he breathes on his hikes in the hills. They are everywhere and therefore seem to him to be nowhere, since he can't trace out the relationships, can't chart the systems of cause and effect. This is the great challenge of his time, he often thinks, a challenge that reappears over and over in various contexts in his life. How, in a world of networks so complex that the classic forms of causation have broken down, is it possible to describe his relationship to the executioner, the torturer, the exploiter of labor, the pillager of land? What is the story that will connect him in all his particularity and immediacy to these other particular and immediate events? At night, he walks the streets of his city, long walks through neighborhoods he doesn't really know. Silhouettes of palm fronds against clouds lit up from beneath, search beams from police helicopters strafing the nearby blocks. Some nights, there is weather, rain, or thick fog, or a tinsely coastal mist. In a drought year, after a summer without rain, the touch of a raindrop to his cheek is like a slap. But this, too, is a false immediacy. Weather is a 20th century phenomenon, one that no longer exists except in novels and car commercials, atmospheric scenes in films. The 21st century is the century of climate, huge and untotalizable, receiving into itself the belched smoke of a million factories, seething constantly with distant, unfelt winds. Of course, the rain he feels is obviously real. It smears the surface of his glasses and soaks through his clothes to his skin, causes a soft, metallic patter on the roofs of the parked cars. Yet at the same time, he knows full well that this reality, the damp denim of his jeans against his thighs, the cotton of his t-shirt clinging to his ribs, is little more than an illusion. For the truth is that the rain is not just the rain anymore. It is not just something about which to worry, rejoice, or complain. Instead, it falls on him like a strange, unsettling message, a missive sent from afar. But a missive whose meaning he cannot hope to decipher because he neither knows the language in which it's written nor the place from which it has been sent. It seems to want to tell him something about huge, impending catastrophes, about massive migrations and widespread famines, extinctions, droughts. Yet because the rain is not linked directly to these catastrophes, because it is absurd to say global warming is falling from the skies tonight, the catastrophes themselves remain cloaked in shadow. He knows that they are there, that they are looming, that they are written into the rain and into the streets along which he walks. But how quickly or how slowly the catastrophes are approaching, and what degree of responsibility he bears for their arrival. These are things of which he can't be sure. And so, night after night, he continues to go out walking, and night after night, he senses the disasters growing near. But night after night, when he looks for these disasters, they aren't there. He reads an interview with the artist Claire Pentecost. In 2008, she says, with reference to one of her projects, "I was feeling a peculiar isolation, an ignorance of my own environment, of who and what make the territory that sustains my life." The words could easily be his own. He is lucky enough, privileged enough, to have woken up on the right side of capitalism, as it were, which means that, for the moment at least, he is fully supported by a global system of production and exchange which he can't even begin to comprehend. But this ignorance, the vast, enshrouded darkness on which his life relies, haunts him. It is an abyss, a hole into which he is always on the verge of falling, a pit whose depths can open up at any instant and in any situation. He already knows that it is a pit full of horrors. What he does not know is whether looking at these horrors, grasping them more intimately as the territory of his life, will make any difference, or whether he will simply gaze at them and, more haunted than ever, continue to live as he already does. Of course, he has what he thinks of as personal concerns as well. His father, for example, still young and seemingly in perfect health, was recently diagnosed with prostate cancer. That conversation took place in the kitchen of his parents' house, and when his father had finished speaking, he had walked to him, he had walked to his father, and had pressed himself against his father as hard as he had ever pressed himself against anyone. It was the image of his father in pain that affected him most, the image of a malignant presence inside this body that he loved so much. And he had held his father harder and harder as though, if he only squeezed him hard enough, he might take the cancerous cells into his own body and trap them there, trap his father's pain inside himself. He does not understand people who are cruel, people who feel they must inflict violence on themselves or others in order to experience the true intensities of life. Cruelty is easy as he sees it. It is what the fact of our isolation, our apparently intractable individuality, seems to demand. How much harder, harder and more fruitful to spend our time seeking new ways of being together, new ways of giving one another space in which to breathe. He remembers when he began to realize, for instance, that this is what sex could be. Not a space to reaffirm one's borders, confirm one's sense of self, but a space to perform the breakdown of borders, to stage a self that is unisolated, unalone. Yet he himself causes pain almost constantly. Not long ago, for example, the condom he was wearing broke, and despite the fact that they went to the pharmacy the next day and bought a morning after pill, the woman with whom he'd been sleeping became pregnant. He didn't love the woman, and he certainly didn't want the child. And though he tried to give her his full support, telling her repeatedly that it was her body and therefore, in the end, her decision, he knew full well that his feelings about the matter were clear. A month later, he drove her to the Planned Parenthood and sat with her in the waiting room. And again, it was the problem of bodies, of wanting and being unable to take the fullness and fear from her body and inject it into his own, to feel the speculum part the walls of his vagina and the prick of the needle when his cervix was numbed, the pressure of the dilators against his uterine walls, and then, at last, the quick, small emptiness as the suction did its strangely gentle work. But instead, when she'd followed a staff person out of the waiting room, he took his car and left the Planned Parenthood's seedy strip mall, found a Starbucks in a middle-class neighborhood some miles away and drank coffee on its shaded patio until she called. He held her in the parking lot while she cried. He hasn't seen her in over a year.
I can't see anything other than the page in front of me when I'm wearing these glasses, so you'll need to be louder.
It's the thing in your back.
Oh, okay. Just in case anybody needs it later. Hi, my name is PC Bickerstaff. I was Professor Robert Harrison Mork's last graduate student. And I'm still friends with his wife, Emily. She asked me to clean up his office after his death in 2063. Behind his heavily annotated copy of Gravity and Grace, I found a series of composition books with the collective titles The Hate Journals of the Hobo Mork. In them, he enumerated and wrote at some length about things he claims to have hated. He also inserted a variety of other texts that he attributed to an alter ego named Floss. After much discussion, we decided that they should be published. The following are selections from Professor Mork's very first notebook. I hope to publish the entirety of his journals in the decades to come. Selections from The Hate Journals of the Hobo Mork, Volume 1, Some Remarks. 1. Most of all, I hate stream of consciousness in fiction. It's pointlessly repeating truncated sentences, iPad on table, plays Berlioz, must turn sound up, tea smells like tea, table looks like table, Berlioz sounds like Hector. And its implicit claim that everything that passes for consciousness in everyone who passes for human is ipso facto deserving of our attention. Its defenders claim that these texts are an accurate depiction of human experience. I can only respond that, one, my experience doesn't look like that, because I am generally able to bring the concepts to bear upon bare experiential factoids, rather than swim on undiscerningly in the river of filth that constantly emanates from the factories, boardrooms, and mouths of our cultural pontifices who live in their creative, sick neighborhoods. I attempt to use what we who are not in business call reason. I accept, of course, that the vast majority of human beings are taught not to orient themselves effectively in this sludge, and that all of us mostly lack the desire to do so, content as we are to be slopped around like chunks of last night's toast in the buttery dishwater of contemporary life. Though, of course, we would never wash the dishes. We let the menials clean the scum from our plates once we've eaten out for the 21st time this week, not counting brunches. My second response, too, is that even were we all such wretched artifacts of our times that unorganized, uncensored responses to the world flooded from our minds like saliva from an abused golden retriever, one couldn't argue on the basis of that so-called fact that such a thing ought to be represented on the page. But enough. My wife tells me I am too literary, that nobody cares about my arguments against Joyce and a fortiori against the flamethrowers. Stop being so bookish, she yells. I bow my head. I turn on the television. Floss presents The Quotidian Individual, a collection of short American literary fiction narratives. Young men go on a road trip. They come home. They have not suddenly changed. A man moves to New York. It is not unlike his previous home. Someone dies of cancer. That's it. They die. We all do. Someone is addicted to hard drugs. They are not sympathetic. They just die. A young woman rebels against an overbearing parent, and later they both apologize. A woman cheats on her spouse, He divorces her. Neither of them are happy. A man has a midlife crisis. He describes it to himself as existential. His wife leaves him. He never realizes that his existential angst will never be interesting. Young people go away to celebrate graduation. They return home and take moderately well-paying jobs. Two people go through difficulties in their marriage. They are bored with each other. They realize that's okay. They stay together. There are far worse things than affectionate boredom. A rich man loses his money. He does not discover happiness. He does not reconnect with family and friends. In fact, he just discovers that being poor is deeply unpleasant. A man gets divorced from his wife. He is okay. So is she. So are the kids. The dog, too, is okay. A young man attends school. He matures. A couple have a child. Their lives, as they know them, are not over. Their lives change, yes, but they are still recognizably their lives. A young woman undergoes a sexual awakening, i.e., she has sex. It's okay. She will probably have it again if she can be bothered. An old man's wife dies. He makes new friends and spends more time reading. He's sad, but what are you going to do? A professional man drives after drinking and kills a little girl. Well, that took a dark turn. He kills a little girl. He goes to prison. It's not so bad. He gets out. He is still a professional. A poor woman is very smart. Nothing comes of it. A young woman doesn't fit in. She is quirky. A quirky teacher takes an interest in her. The young woman goes to college. The quirky teacher is alone. A youth works at a menial job. All his friends that he is too know he is too talented to be stuck there. He follows his dreams. 18 months later, he gratefully accepts his old job back. A young woman has a learning difficulty. It does not enable her to see things the rest of us can't. It's just frustrating. She has trouble understanding things. She wishes it were otherwise. A young man struggles with his identity. Late at night, to the ocean, he yells, "Who am I?" Once he has completed puberty, he realizes that the question makes no sense. He is not special. Nobody taken on their own is special. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sydney. Sydney Borelli. I'm going to read three poems that are from a collection I'm working on that's titled Super Fucking Average. The first poem is called A Child. You were a child for the first time, face burrowed between my shoulder blades. They stick out now, not as far as I want them to, but almost. You said I felt good, said you missed me, said more until you almost cried, but didn't. I pushed my body into your body, pushed bone into muscle. You said my name, sighed, fingered my ribs one by one. They stick out now, not as far as I want them to, but almost. You said I felt good, said my name, said you missed me, pressed your lips against my back. You turned my body bone after bone, held my face between your hands, thumbs on jawbone. It sticks out now, not as far as I want it to, but almost. You said I felt good, said you missed me, said you missed me, said you missed me. You cried. You were not a child again in the morning. Body on other side of bed, body away from body. You said, sorry, said too much to drink, said sorry, said sorry, said sorry. I almost cried, but didn't. This is a new poem called I Thought We Learned, and it is dedicated to Melanie Spiegel. She asked me how we got here. I didn't answer for a while. I leaned forward and peeled my sweat-sticky thighs from the metal-woven chair that was built for and remains outside in the heavy heat of Camarillo. It got cold fast, later at dusk, like the desert does. I looked around at the maze of single-story terracotta buildings. Outlet malls all look the same where I am from. Unfamiliar sameness to me. We had wandered while waiting for her, not my family. She said my name with a question mark. I apologized, something I am good at, and said we made a left somewhere between Nike and Brooks Brothers. The car is over there, a gesture. It is hot. An opinion. I am out of cigarettes, a fact. She put her feet, her worn rubber sneakers, on the table, made of the same woven metal, metal that so easily steals heat from the sun. She said that wasn't what she meant. Here, a gesture of vastness. This place, a gesture the same. Again, a sigh. The sky was more white than blue, bleached and unnatural like the split and dry ends of my hair that clung to my sweat, sticky back. I told her I didn't know. I told her I was sorry. I told her I thought we had learned. I told her I thought we had learned how to be not here. This is the last poem. It's called Lost Dog. I always turn left at a certain intersection when I drive home from a certain part of Los Angeles. It's more difficult to turn left during rush hour when everyone is lined up to get on the freeway I used to take before I graduated high school, before things were supposed to change, but didn't. It's late, late enough that I'm pretty tired, even though I did the cocaine that everyone else did. Late enough that the intersection isn't busy at all. But I'm waiting for a car to pass, even though it's far enough away that the headlights blur into two soft circles that almost touch. A Jeff Buckley song comes on that I like, even though everyone likes it. I turn up the volume and I wait for the car to pass before I turn left. But it passes, and I don't turn because there's a dog running down the street. And I know it's lost, and I want to get out of my car because I think that maybe I can help it find its way home, even though I don't know where it lives. But it's late enough that I think it could tell me where home is, and I could tell it to stop running. But I don't get out of my car, because the Jeff Buckley song gets quieter, and I realize the dog is running too fast for me to ever catch up. So I just watch it run down the street until it disappears or fades out of view. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.